Hi, welcome to Folkcraft. I'm Temperance.
And I'm honorary hex girl, Erin Oberyn.
And today we're going to be having an open dialogue on hexing. This is really going to be just a conversation between us, not structured, because I think we both have opinions, and I don't know Erin's opinion, but I'm pretty sure it aligns with mine. So I'm just going to give the stance that, one, I'm hex positive, and with that, I think that there are some ethics that should be widely adopted about hexing. So there's no unified, you know, ethics code that all witches live by. But I personally have some opinions on what makes something morally and ethically acceptable to hex and when it's not. So I'm curious, do you have anything like that?
So I talk about hexing a lot in my book, and kind of publicly. I think hexing is really crucial to witchcraft. They are inextricably linked through folklore and history, but also like the current practice. I think not that every witch has to hex, but if hexing is something that you could just never see yourself doing, then maybe witchcraft is not the magical practice for you. In terms of like a code of conduct, for myself, yeah. For other people, no. I don't know what's going on in someone else's life, so I can't really judge or put any kind of like assigned moral value to hexing, because I also don't believe in universal morals. So yes and no. Is that a helpful answer? Is that clear?
I guess so. Like, to me, I think, I think the community grows and thrives on its independence, on its self-sovereignty, on not being unified by a communal dictator. So when we talk about hexing and we get into those conversations of rule of three, that's always the conversation that comes up, right? Like, you can't do this rule of three, it'll come back to you. Well, I think that takes a lot of nuance out of the conversation. I think that someone should be able to hex, for example, an abuser or, you know, someone who has done severe negative action. I don't jump to hexing as my first response. I'll usually try to work things out in a mundane manner. If, you know, we go our separate ways, we talk it out. If we need to block each other, we block each other, whatever the case is. But, you know, there's ways in which it escalates. And as magical practitioners, we have to take control over our power, over our self-sovereignty. The only time that I personally, there's a few times, it's not the only time, but the major thing for me that I don't believe in hexing is someone unrelated. So like people's children, I feel like is an unfair target to hex. People's animals, people's spouses, those are all like big red flag territories for me, where like, I know we don't have a community law or code of conduct about this, but I personally believe that ethically, morally, we should not be hexing those particular types of people.
Oh, if you're hexing kids and animals, you're kind of a piece of shit. And I say this as someone coming from a folkloric background where one of the main things that witches do are hex livestock. I'm too much of a fucking millennial in that regard. Like, no, that's fucked up. I'm not down with that. Kids especially. And again, like, so I'm talking very specifically to my folkloric people out there. We are inspired. We are not adherents to the folklore. We do not have to be like gospel truthing everything that we see there. I don't, like, for me personally, I'm very much like you. Like, I have this like reputation as the spooky ooky southern witch, but I really don't curse often for two reasons. One, there's probably just an easier way to deal with it, right? Honestly. And two, very few people are worth that amount of time for me. And yeah, that's how I like to frame it in terms of like investment. Am I going to spend the time? Because if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. And if I'm doing it right, that means it takes a hot minute to do. So are you really, really worth my time and attention in this manner? A. And do I really want to be whipping your ass from here to Kalamazoo?
Yeah, well, you know, and like a successful hex or curse takes actually a pretty significant sacrifice out of the person performing that spell work. So I have to make sure that you're worth the energy that I'm about to expend, and you're going to be worth whatever I'm going to have to do in response. So I think, you know, there's so many layers of nuance, but, you know, there's always those conversations surrounding hexing that, shit, I remembered, I knew I wanted to hold it, and then I lost it. I thought I would get it back by the time that I used all my filler words, and I didn't.
No worries. I did actually want to say something on the whole rule of three things, so we can kind of use that time to get back to that. That is the specific religious belief of one magical practice, Wicca. It is not some trying to apply the rule of three or the law of three or the Wiccan read to a non-Wiccan individual would be the same as saying that we have to, as non-Christians, we should be following the Ten Commandments. It is a form of religious supremacy and dominance. Not as powerful and overlaying as Christianity, obviously, but it is the same kind of tactic that my religious conviction, my religious belief is the correct one. And even if you aren't a part of my religion, if you call yourself a witch, that's close enough and you should be doing what my religion tells you to do. So I think that's something that we really need to keep in mind. And also, like, the rule of three in and of itself has a very odd history because it comes to us from Gerald Gardner, but not from one of his religious books. It comes from one of his fiction books. It comes from one of his novels. Now, this is kind of hearsay because I can't find copies of these fucking things. But I believe it's in High Magic's Aid. And that is where this, like, what you put out into the universe comes back to you comes from. And of course, we get it exacerbated because no doubt the witchcraft occult community gets influenced by New Age beliefs. And the secret, and for anyone who doesn't know, the secret is this whole, like, law of attraction, where whatever you're putting out into the universe, you're reflecting it in the universe and it's coming back to you. So I remember reading it as a teenager. There's even a section where they say, imagine a very specific feather with very specific patterns. And if you just hold that image in your mind, you're going to manifest. This is where we get the parlance of manifest in our common day conversations. It will manifest in your life the exact same one. So The Secret had a huge influence that I don't think we acknowledge. And that interlaces this whole rule of three thing. All of that to say, the rule of three is absolutely not a universal truth to the practice of even just magic, but especially witchcraft.
Yeah, well, you know, and we, you know, you touch on the rule of three, and I don't know if it was Gerald Gardner who was the rule of three, but I don't know that it wasn't, because honestly, it's something that I haven't had to look up in a long time to, like, reference. But I know for sure the Wiccan read comes out of a poem. And, you know, Wicca is not this super ancient lineage. And it's time that it's 2022. We have to be honest with each other about our origins, about what we're doing, what we believe, because, you know, early Wicca was like, oh yeah, this is the ancient form of witchcraft, the ancient form of Wicca. And then, you know, as we've gone on, we've been able to be honest and be like, actually, you know, Gerald Gardner created this in this specific time frame. It's built off of these specific things. You know, it has a lot of Golden Dawn influence. It has a lot of Reconstructionist stuff in it. So there's a lot that goes into Wicca that's not from Wicca, and it's not ancient, and it's not an unchanged lineage, and the Wheel of the Year is not some unchanged calendar that pagans have used forever. And these are important conversations that we have to have, and part of that transparency is, okay, well, is the rule of three just kind of misinterpreted karma? And at the end of the day, I, as a personal practitioner, do not believe in the concept of karma. Karma does not come into my spiritual circle at all. It's not part of my religious upbringing. It's not part of my cultural upbringing. So I have no reason to believe in this concept of the rule of three. And if I hex someone, it's going to come back. I hope it fucking hits them three times as harder. That's the rule of three that I'm living by.
I love that you brought up karma, because this is something that is so dramatically bastardized throughout I'm not going to say the West broadly because I don't know that that's true, but at least in America, the idea of karma is so bastardized. And I now that it's been brought up, I just have to say it. Karma in its original form, and I say this as someone who has a background in anthropology, but not a background specifically in Hinduism, but karma does come to us out of a Hindu context. It has to deal with actions in this life affecting our next life, if you believe in the very specific form of reincarnation as it appears in Hinduism. And I say Hinduism, but there's many, many variations of that. Like, even saying that is misleading. Just even in India, Hinduism is not one thing, right? There's what we might think of as like sects. There's many variations. Just like it is probably one of the most diverse religions just in theology in the world. And it is one of the, if not the oldest continuous big religion in the world. So anyway, the idea of karma as like, ooh, that's karma. Karma got you because you did this bad thing once. That is 100% American, like, idea of what karma is that is not reflective of what karma actually means in any way, shape, or form. I think what people mean is, like, that's what you get. You did a bad thing and now a bad thing happened to you. And I'm down with that. Like, bringing it back into the context of hexing, if you're, and I bring it back because I think one of the things in baneful work, Maleficium, that gets overlooked, like, there's a lot of talk about the rule of three and karma. How about the most realistic thing, which is counter cursing? Like, if you want to talk about something coming back to you and biting you in the ass, it's counter cursing. And I think it's a bit less of a concern now, unless you're hexing another practitioner. But you also have to keep into, like, when we look at the folklore, this is the most common theme, right? We see counter cursing constantly happening time and time again. It's a huge theme. And a lot of the stories are how to protect yourself from witchcraft, right? And I don't think many people outside of the witchcraft sphere in modern America are really doing a lot of anti-witchcraft work. Although now there's this weird right-wing explosion of witch exposures in churches happening right now. So that's a little concerning. But by and large, their traditional counter-cursing is not happening. What is happening are there are people who are praying, and prayer is so powerful. And I feel like, maybe not on this podcast, but in other things, I've been kind of a broken record in that prayer is so powerful, and pagans are so unable to, and I say pagan, I mean occultist, I kind of lump it all together.
You mean me. Is unable to.
I mean you, Temperance. But people are so unable to process their religious trauma and baggage that they won't admit that there's power there. And they can't allow themselves to think that Christianity has power. And so those prayers can absolutely be counter-cursing, can absolutely send shit right back to you. Is it going to be as targeted as a counter-curse? In my opinion, no, because a counter-curse is, again, it's targeted. It's specifically looking for the thing, but it can still happen. Your curses can be broken by prayer circles. If you've never been to a place where you've been full of the Holy Spirit and spoken in tongues and seen laying of hands, then you probably just don't understand how incredibly powerful it is. But you cannot downplay it. You can be the best cursor, you can be the most skilled hex crafter, and still have your shit sent back to you.
Yeah.
And I think, well, that is the most real concern a hexer should have.
We both live in the South. And something that's really big here that a lot of people might not know about is prayer warriors. Mm-hmm. And so this is a concept that it directly relates back to that. There's this concept of like these people will get together, like groups of them, evangelicals, mostly Southern evangelicals, will get together and pray over the downfall of particular people, institutions, structures. It's a very targeted form of cursing. And so I personally don't believe in political hexing or cursing. I don't think that it's effective. And my opinion on that is because, let's say that I wanted to curse Donald Trump. He's the acting president. I want to curse him. I want whatever to happen. Who's to say that he doesn't have someone praying over his protection as well? Just me sending out that curse doesn't mean that it's going to be effective. It doesn't mean it's going to hit. And especially when we're talking about big figures, big people, countries, any kind of institution, you're most likely not the only person performing some form of magical working over it. And, you know, as witches, we like to think, oh, like there's no one else that would do magic against them, or like no one's going to use witchcraft or hex them. We are not the only magical practitioners. We use a specific name and we do a specific practice, but we're not the only ones that include mysticism in our practices.
So we disagree on, not for yourself, but in general, that political hexing doesn't work. But I do 100% agree on your rationale as to why it is often ineffective. Hexing Trump? What nonsense. He is one of the most, I will say it straight up, he's probably one of the most magically protected people in this country. I have seen it. I have seen people doing these circles. He had a tongue-speaking, she's a wild person. I've seen one video. I do not know this person's name, but the angels of this and that person, what is, I don't know her name. But that is someone who specifically works for his protection constantly. And her ministry is working for his protection constantly. Again, people want to downplay the power of ecstatic, charismatic Christianity. And that is foolishness. He absolutely is one of the most protected. Now, does that mean that you can't get an effective curse through? No, you can. You just have to be very, very smart about it. You have to look for where are the cracks, you know, is he might be being prayed over, but are his companies being prayed over? Yeah, probably actually. But you know, that's the process, right? If you're going to go through things, you look at things within your own moral lens, right? We said earlier, like don't hex kids, but that's not hexing like minors is a very different thing than like the Trumps. They're all grown ass folks, right? So, and they're also awful humans who are contributing to the downfall of the world. So, totally fair game. In those regards, I think you can find, you just have to be smart. I think to be effective at Maleficium and Baneful Workings, you have to just be targeted with what you're trying to do. Especially if you want your baneful working to create positive change in the world, and positive, of course, is very subjective because what we think of positive is what these prayer warriors are thinking of as satanic. I mean, satanic isn't bad, but, you know, the downfall of civilization. So it is very, very subjective stuff.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, when we encapsulate all of this, it comes down to, I think, you know, when is it okay? When isn't it okay? Because like you said, like I said, we both discussed it. This is a person that would be very difficult to properly, and it's my opinion. It's my belief. And it's fine that you disagree with me. And I don't think that we should agree on everything because no two magical practitioners are going to agree on the practice of witchcraft. But I don't think that you can successfully hex an institution. I think there's too many people, as we've said, like doing counter magic. So wasting your time and energy on hexing someone like Donald Trump, is it fun? Yeah. Is it showy? Sure. Is it going to get you attention if you're doing it in a public setting or you've got a group of people and now it's making NPR headlines? Cool. Good for you. But that doesn't mean that your spell work is going to be effective.
I mean, I think that's a really good point. I don't think that public cursing is effective magic. Do I think it's effective politics? Actually, a little bit. I think that organizations like Witch which is an acronym, and I don't remember what the acronym is. This is what happens when we don't have an outline, but I think that they're pretty effective. I don't know that they've been active in recent years, but they were very active in the first few years. Lana Del Rey's public hacks of Donald Trump. I mean, it raised awareness. It is it's effective performance art.
Mm-hmm.
It's ineffective magic, because magic done in the public sphere is easily countered by just people's knowledge of it, because you pray against it. It doesn't even have to necessarily be a super conscious thing, right? Let's talk about the evil eye. The evil eye is a concept that you can look at someone and, without necessarily strongly intending to, put baneful workings on them. This can sometimes be out of jealousy or out of anger, but the evil eye is, in its broadest sense, right? The concept that anyone has the capacity to hex, curse, or otherwise put negative, non-beneficial working on another person without being a trained magic practitioner.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't we assume that the reverse is also possible? So if we're publicly hexing, if we're publicly saying, like, I am actively doing this and I want it to be on the news, which I think is a lot different than people doing it, like, through Instagram, through small communities. I think there's still, you run a risk there, but it's not nearly as palpable as, like, no, we want NPR headlines. If you're publicly putting your magic out there, people are going to undo it. It's just going to happen.
Well, then you're also dealing with, again, if it's a public act, you're dealing with the potential for a counter hex or a counter curse. And are you prepared to deal with the fallout for that? Like, if you attack someone publicly and then they decide to call it out, or it makes headlines, or whatever the case is, you need to make sure that you're going to be able to protect yourself from whatever fallout may occur from that.
Which is why there is a benefit to doing group cursing. And this is something that I don't think gets talked about often, but as always, I'm going to go back to the folklore, right? We actually see this as a really common occurrence through not just American folklore, but also Scottish and English witchcraft trials and folklore as well, where covens will convene, and I'm using covens super loosely here, but a coven of witches will convene with the purpose of cursing someone. This could be a magistrate or a sheriff, or some other high ranking, or it could just be someone who's a douche, and you would just come together to undo that person. So if you're targeting a single person, and again, this is a lot harder in a day where, like, everybody knows everybody's name and is praying for their success or downfall constantly. But if you and a group of people are working against a certain particular individual, if someone does a counter curse and it is effective, it's going to be dispersed, because now you're having, what, 12, 13, 14 people targeting one person. One person is undoing it and trying to push it back against 14 other people. It's going to be nowhere near as effective as when those 14 people were targeting a single person, right? So it becomes diffused. In American folklore, we get witch balls or hair balls.
Mm-hmm.
Which are these little balls of wax, hair, and other sundry things. And witches come together, make these normally on Friday the 13th to curse and harm other people. It is very, very... Two important characteristics of it are that everyone contributes hair into it. Now, I do believe that you can make these without having a coven or anything like that. But that is one of the defining characteristics in the folklore. And also that you do not lose the balls themselves when you throw them. And again, stories and mileage will vary. I have always taken that to mean that one of the things that makes witch balls particularly effective is that any attempt to counter curse against their effects are A, limited by having the tangible object, which looks like trash and is very easily just thrown away rather than kept and stored. And B, now you're trying to target amongst a sea of other people who are connected to this one object. So that's one of the ways of protecting yourself from counter magic, is having a group of people that basically, it's pin the tail on the donkey, find the right witch. you know, and find the right witch randomly through magic. You know what I mean?
But I did want to bring it back. So earlier in the episode, I was like, I have to say something, but it completely slipped my mind. But it's come back up because we've actually gotten to the point where it's relevant. There's this dialogue in the community, and I've heard it from a number of practitioners. Well, I don't believe in cursing. And if you don't believe in the curse, it's not real. It can't hurt you. And that's one of the dumbest dialogues that this community has. And I'm usually not that harsh. Like, you guys know, you guys have listened. This is my podcast. You listen to it. You know, I'm usually not that harsh. But that's a fucking stupid take. Oh, I don't believe in it, so it's not real. I don't believe in oxygen, so I'm going to stop breathing. Like, I don't believe in water, so I don't have to drink it. You don't believe in cursing, so it can't hurt you. That is not how you protect yourself against baneful magic. If you don't believe in cursing and you don't think it's going to hurt you, you're probably going, if you piss the wrong person off, you may feel the negative effects of that. Or if you don't believe in it, or you don't believe in witchcraft, you know, to that purpose, there's a lot of people that come in and they get so caught up in the mysticism. They get so caught up in the healing and the light work. And that's great. There's a community for that. But this particular community, hexes and curses. And so if you're going to be in this community, you need to know how to protect yourself within it and work within it, because there are things that can happen to you if you're cursed. There's historical, we have so much documentation of like people saying I was cursed or I cursed this person, and then things happen to that person. Like, it's demonstrable that it occurs.
And also, people in this community are petty. Like, I'm going to be straight up. People are petty and they'll curse you for no reason, or for what you believe to be no reason, right? And I have heard this dialogue of like, well, if you don't believe in the curse, it can't have power. You know when I heard that? When I was fucking 14 years old. So it is kind of wild to me to hear that again as an adult who's been practicing magic for, God, 15 years now. More than 15 at this point. It is insane to me to think that your belief affects anyone other than yourself. And of course, someone could say like, oh, but if someone else casting a curse on me is affecting me, so my belief... No. You're not casting that spell, so your conviction of the effectiveness of that spell doesn't matter. In fact, there's entire schools of magic who don't believe that your quote-unquote intent or conviction matters at all in magic. It's just using the correct formula in order to achieve the correct result. So it's a take you can have. And I do want to open space for that to be... I feel very judgmental in this moment. But at the same time, I recently had a conversation with someone about, and I do think this is related, it'll sound like it's not, the conversation surrounding Christianity and atheism, where Christians will say like, well, you know, if I'm wrong about hell, then, you know, oh, well, I lived a good life and had a church family and I was wrong. If you're wrong, then... you spend all of eternity in a lake of fire. And I don't want to come off that way by saying, you know, your conviction or lack thereof with cursing is going to end up putting you in a precarious situation. But that is a conversation between two people who belong to two vastly different worldviews. Whereas within this community, we all are kind of unified by the belief that magic exists, right? Like, that's the general idea, right? That if you're calling yourself a witch, you probably believe that magic is real, unless you're one of those people that think that it's all psychology and or bad psychology and ritual. So it's wild to me to believe that magic is real, but not believe that other people's magic can have an effect on you if you choose not to let it. I guess that's what they're saying. That's wild to me. And if you're convicted of that, then hey, more power to you. But I don't buy that. I don't buy it at all. I'm not renting. I'm not buying. I'm not buying to own. None of the above.
I think that that take is given by people who, and this is not, if you're listening to this and you feel like, no, I have that opinion, I have that stance. My only critique of it is that you probably have not experienced enough witchcraft and enough magic and have had enough spiritual experiences yet to be shown otherwise. Because a lot of people, logic, they come into this through the lens of like, well, I'm going to be kind of clinical about it. I don't want to get too woo-woo. I'm going to stay grounded and like believe what's tangible. If you haven't had that spiritual experience yet that makes you think, oh shit, magic's real, I can see how this could be a stance that you have.
But that comes back to, do you believe magic is real? And if you believe magic is real, then your worldview should be opening up and allowing for beneficium and maleficium.
Yeah. You know, so I pro-hex. You pro-hex. I know some people that are like, that's their first reaction. They have an issue with someone. They're like, I'm hexing them. And I don't think that that should be the first, as said earlier in this episode, I don't think that should ever be the first course of action. But if it needs to happen, I'll do it. I'll fucking do it. And I'm never going to apologize for that.
No, and I don't think we should. I think it's a part of our tradition, and it's something that it happens importantly. And I will say, everyone hexes for different reasons. You can be petty. I don't personally do that, but you do you. I mean, that's the whole point of witchcraft, right? Is that we are... not the whole point. I guess that's more of a exaggeration. But, I mean, we're doing what we want to do.
We're affecting change in the world the way we see fit.
Exactly. So, you do you. To me, again, it comes back to that, do I want to take the time? And I think because for me, cursing either requires an investment of time. I would say that cursing is probably one of my more labor-intensive magical workings because it normally requires me to craft an image of the target, right? So we've done episodes where we've talked about image magic and the creation of puppets and dolls. And this is a very, very imperative one. We are a folk magic podcast, and one of the oldest forms of baneful magic is to make a puppet and to do various things to it, you know.
That's sympathetic magic. I would just love to just define it if people need to look it up later. There's tons of books on sympathetic magic, which is magic that is used in the image of something, or something takes the place of whatever that you're targeting.
Right. Sympathetic magic is connected to this larger, I think we've had this discussion before where I've talked about the anthropological roots of these terms and how sympathetic magic is like that which looks like is, and the law of contagion, which is that which has come into contact is still in contact, right? So some of the oldest forms of puppet magic is to make the puppet of someone and then to bury it at a very busy crossroads and basically have that person be underfoot forever. So basically lower them, right? Yeah, I see your eyebrows going up. So you make the image of this person, in the original story, this is coming out of the Silver Bullet, you put them in a coffin. It's a puppet in a coffin. You bury it in a dirt road. The busier, the better, because everyone walking over that is then tampering them down even more. So they continue to always be underfoot, meaning that they do not have power over you and they cannot up against you. They cannot harm you. They can't do anything to you. They're under your foot. They're under the foot of everyone in town, everyone in the community.
I love that. That's so good. I haven't read that. I don't know that I have read that text, but I have something similar that I do just personally. And I think like everyone, I'll just share it because everyone can definitely. So if you go to Michael's or Joanne's, they have those little paintable wood section of like wood thing, like wood figure statue things. Okay. Well, they've got one that looks like a pirate's treasure chest. And if you get the pirate's treasure chest, you can put them into the coffin, into the chest, and then you seal it in with demons, and then you do what you do with it, whatever you're going to do with it, but you seal them in with their own demons.
Obsessed. Oh, I love that. And I think this is where we get into, like, cursing is fun. Combining methods. Do that and then throw them in the dirt. Throw them in that busy road. Every time they start to make progress with those demons, someone steps over them. Someone steps them down deeper into the dirt. Another variation of that is to make multiples and put them at various parts of a town or crossroads, like entry points into town, as a way to keep them from entering town. It's like, I'm sure you've heard the expression walking. Someone just walked over my grave. No?
I've heard, like, they're rolling in their grave.
Okay, maybe this is, like, a very specific thing to me then. There's this thing that my family would say, and I'm pretty sure I've heard other people say it, where they'll get, like, goose pimples and be like, ooh, someone just walked over my grave. And it's basically the idea. Like,
that
the
must be a Southern thing, because my even though I've lived in Florida nearly my whole life, I'm actually from New England, so that might be a Southern saying.
It very well might be. Basically, like, the idea is that the spot where one day you will be buried is connected to you now, and walking over it is an uncomfortable feeling for you. Like, no matter where you are in the world, if someone walks over your grave, it's an uncomfortable thing. So put these images of this person at multiple points where they could enter into your quote-unquote territory, and make it so that if they are crossing into your territory, they would have to walk over their own grave, which, you know, it, as many things in folklore, they can't do, right? Witches can't enter a house if there's a bowl of grains in front of them, because they have to count them all. Like, it's these kind of laws of folklore, right? Things that don't necessarily, or folk magic, that don't necessarily make sense to us, but in the spiritual context do make sense. Those are some of my favorites from the folklore. One of the ones that I probably do the most is something of draining characteristic and withering. I've heard one of my favorite people, Via Hedera, has used the term withering spells, and ever since then I'm like, oh, absolutely. And it is exactly what it says. The closer you get to me, the more that you do to me, the more of yourself gets leached into this other thing. If you're living in Florida, that might be a strangler fig, right? You might take someone's name and write it 7 times and roll it up, or take their image, their picture, one of their personal concerns or tag locks, and put that into a very healthy, like the crevice of a very healthy strangler fig, and let that grow over them to consume them.
I've definitely heard of this. So this is the second time this week something called a withering spell has come into my circle. So maybe it's something I'm supposed to research. But I recently heard that term from someone who practices brujería. So I was like, this is not a term that I would have used on my own. But I love the concept that the more that, because I've done similar spells, like the more someone does something to me, XYZ will happen to them in return.
Right.
And so I love the concept of that. The more someone does something to me, the more they get taken away.
And it's something that's not exclusive to any one culture. I don't know that the term is either. I like the term withering because I've done versions of it in the past. And I think some of the most classic witch behavior is a withering spell, something that causes someone to age, to fall decrepit, but it's not an illness that can be traceable. We see this with a lot of tree-based spells, right? You stunt the growth of a tree and you baptize the tree in the name of the person you want to harm. And then that tree, like the harm that comes to that tree happens to that person. We also have the sitting demons, right? Or the familiars that get into the chest of people, which is just, it's less of a spell and more of an action. You send out your familiar and you tell them, you know, go sit on the chest of this person, go stifle this person so that they cannot do what it is that they want to do. And I don't think that that's something we've talked about very much, which is the role of familiars in magic in general, in witchcraft in general.
But you have to have a whole episode on it maybe next time we record.
And writing that down, putting that on the docket. But I mean, the familiar plays an absolutely huge role in this kind of work. Being able to just go out, and there's no spell really required. It requires you to have a strong relationship with a spirit and to tell that spirit, hey, go sit on the chest of this person. If they try to do X, Y, and Z, like set your conditions and then say, sit on their chest. Keep them from doing this thing. Everyone talks about the sleep paralysis demons, so they won't even think twice about it when it happens. You know what I mean?
Gaslighting through magic. That is our open dialogue on hexing. You know, let us know your thoughts. And I think it should just be an open dialogue. Everyone's got a different opinion. Yeah. And these are ours. So where can the people find you, Aaron?
You can find me on the Instagrams at Aaron Obrin. You can find my book, Southern Cunning, Folkloric Witchcraft in the American South, wherever books are sold. What about you, Miss Tamp?
I am Temperance. My book, Year of the Witch, is also available everywhere books are sold. I'm at Wild Woman Witchcraft on Instagram, Temperance Alden on Twitter, and I'm just like on the internet, various places. Search my name, you'll find me. Have a good day.
Bye. Goodbye.